Dr. Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. This show today will reveal a whole lot of science. We have Dr. Peter McCullough back on set. This man, I learned, spends hours every morning going over the world literature. He has a mind that misses nothing and a memory that captures everything. So when he speaks, he'll also give you the author, the study, and the key points in that study. And he is a wealth of knowledge. We cover SARS-CoV-2 like never before, the role of the U.S. in gain-of-function research, everything COVID-19 from safety to adverse events, efficacy, early treatments, and he covers natural immunity and even what he's discovered between the childhood vaccine schedule and autism. This is a information science-packed episode. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My topic today is freedom. Freedom is what drives me. It's my passion. I am passionate about medical freedom, but all freedom. This country was founded on a desire, I believe, for freedom. And so many have lost their lives in various wars fighting for our ability to have freedom. When I lost my license, it actually removed the shackles of bondage that I was feeling because I couldn't express myself without being at risk for losing my license. I'm now free. So I'm free to educate, to inform, to talk to you here on With the Wind, in my blogs, on Substack, and then of course at Kids First Forever, where we can educate, inform, and coach. You know, no one can make you do anything. So we need to all remember that. We are free people. Let us be ourselves. That's how we win. So here's to freedom. Welcome, Dr. Peter McCullough. It's so great to have you back on With the Wind.
Well, thanks for having me back on, Paul.
For those who don't know this gentleman, he is my absolute top hero in the world of medicine. You've been a cardiologist.
Previously been chief of cardiology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I had moved up the academic ranks. So sure, I was, as replete with academic credentials as anybody out there.
Yeah. And now you're one of the most published, if not the most published, in the world of COVID. So you have stayed very active academically and you see patients.
Yeah, I have. I've always been active academically. And the way things work now, we work in collaborative groups. We don't have to be in a brick and mortar medical school anymore to publish. In fact, we just submitted a paper today to the New England Journal of Medicine, the largest autopsy paper in patients who have died after COVID-19 vaccines. Really stunning results. But I have over 70 peer-reviewed papers in COVID, despite the headwinds. You know, I've had an initial letter was published in Lancet before the biases started to sweep in to editorial offices. But having said that, what I've always done, Paul, is I've always cited the data, as I will on this interview. And, I've done it on national TV. And of all the experts who brought on and discussed COVID, I'm the only expert that gives the first author and the content so people can look up the papers themselves. I've done it on, you know, ABC and Fox, Newsmax, One America News, Real America Voice, all of them.
Yeah.
And everyone's become used to it. I think that's what set all the records on the Joe Rogan podcast. I told the Spotify producers, I'm going to cite the data. And it pays off. I mean, that's the discipline that doctors should have in the media.
Yeah. Well, I've shared a stage with you before. I've heard you speak multiple times. I don't know anybody in the world that can cite the first author, the name of the article, what journal it was published in, and the key findings of the article. Like, you have an amazing mind. So thank you for being persistent. In spite of the forces that are out there that are trying to keep us silent.
Well, Paul, the reason why it's so critical, especially today, is these unqualified anonymous fact checkers who make false counterclaims.
Yeah.
And, every time, I think they've given up on doing this for me anymore. But when they did it, I would just say, well, here's the paper. This is, what we're reviewing. There is no such thing as misinformation in our field. I've never taken a board question on this. It's never come up seeing a patient in the office. They're simply scientific data and, you know, two or more interpretive points of view. As we discuss some papers today, we'll have different viewpoints. That's what the scientific inquiry process is supposed to be. No one holds agency over the truth. No one holds information and therefore someone else is spreading misinformation. Those are propaganda techniques, propaganda terms. And I'll tell you another thing that doesn't exist. That's another weaponized term is called anti-science. That some people are pro-science and anti-science. Science is a process. We use it in medicine. Medicine is both an art and a science. So we actually use both as we take care of patients. So I think it's important to make sure we have a good command over the terms, not use any weaponized terms, and simply just discuss the issues at hand.
Yeah, thank you. Well, before we dive into the science, and we will in a moment, just so folks have a sense of what you've gone through, and you don't have to go through the whole long list, but, you know, doctors who speak the truth, especially about vaccines or COVID, are under fire. And are you able to speak at all about what you've had to endure?
Yeah, I really don't want to make it about me, but briefly, I've been dismissed from two jobs with a perfect track record for no reason. Released from two editorships by certified mail or email, again, no reason, stripped of all my NIH committees, various Data Safety Monitoring Board positions, any external pharmaceutical consulting is gone, stripped of two professorships with no faculty senate, no due process. And now the American Board of Internal Medicine is attempting to strip me of my medicine residency, my cardiology fellowship. Wow. Again, for non-clinical reasons. ABIM is most egregious. They launched a COVID misinformation policy in the fall of 2019, and then they went back to March of 2019 to my Texas Senate testimony, and they accused me of COVID misinformation, and then they convicted me in a closed meeting that I couldn't attend. The people on the panel, none of whom had any publications in COVID. They'd had no experience in public testimony. They weren't competent, in my view, to even judge the data. When I finally got their decision, now I'm appealing based on both substantive and procedural grounds. So this has been a huge administrative grind, Paul. This is not new to you. I know you've been through a lot worse, but you know, this has been years grinding away. I've been sued by a major health system for allegations of bringing them into the media, which I didn't. And then finally, after 18 months, the judge dismissed the case. But this is the type of thing that's going on now for doctors who don't go along with the false government narrative.
Yeah. Despite that massive amount of energy and effort it takes to, you know, stand up for yourself and fight for your rights, you have been prolific at publishing 70 articles, testifying, and then speaking. Would you hazard a guess, how many times have you testified in the last 3 years?
I've testified dozens of times, Paul. I've had probably thousands of media clips out there. I've been on ABC and Fox, Newsmax, One American News, been a frequent contributor by invitation to The Hill in the first year of the pandemic. I have my own podcast like you do, America Out Loud Talk Radio, McCullough Report, 3 years running weekly podcast. I haven't missed a single weekend. I have the top doctor account on Twitter of doctors who see patients. I moved my practice twice, and patients are, you know, coming in from all over the country to see me. Many times they simply just want to say thanks for me standing up for the truth. And yeah, you know, I was the first doctor to publish a treatment approach to outpatient COVID-19, and many others were working on it in France, yeah, elsewhere. So I want to give credit to all the other doctors. And then I was persistent and bringing that message to the world. And I was the first doctor, Paul, the only doctor who's a public figure who questioned the COVID-19 vaccines in writing before they came out. And I published an op-ed in The Hill August 7th of 2020. And the title of the op-ed was "The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program." And, you know, that's all for the lawmakers in Washington, the White House. They saw it all. And when we go back, I ask the question, who else made the call in Washington? Nobody did.
Yeah. Thank you for standing strong. Let's dive into some data. You, I think, better than anybody are qualified to help us understand this whole COVID saga. Let's start with the origins of the SARS-CoV-2 virus And did the U.S. have a role in it? Was there gain of function activities going on behind this?
We've learned a lot from the House Select Committee for investigation into the origins of the novel coronavirus, led by Representative Comer and assisted by Chip Roy. And I've talked to Chip Roy, Texas representative, multiple times. This is what we've learned, that indeed SARS-CoV-2 was engineered in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, the blueprints for this came from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Ralph Barrick, his senior author, was Vineet Menacheri. The NGO EcoHealth Alliance and Peter Daszak, they were the ones who shuttled the plans to the Chinese. All this was funded by the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, Anthony Fauci's division. And this was going on years before COVID. Barrick published two papers, 2015, declaring that they had created the chimeric virus, the artificial virus that could invade the humanized respiratory epithelial tract. They were also working on monoclonal antibodies and killed vaccines in those papers. So that all fits together. I think the bombshell came out that we learned that the government had 3 years of a narrative that said the vaccine came out of nature or came out of a fish market. And we learned that that was intentional. Anthony Fauci, former NIAID director, and Francis Collins, head of the NIH, they actually had a meeting with Jeremy Farrar at the Wellcome Trust, Peter Daszak at EcoHealth Alliance, multiple Christian Anderson at Scripps, Edwin Holmes at University of Sydney. And they actually came up with an intentional academic deception plan. And they published 12 fraudulent papers in high-level journals saying that the virus arose out of nature when they knew it came out of the lab in Wuhan, China. Actually, it was their project. So they intentionally deceived America. And then the most telling testimony was by former CDC Director Redfield, who said, listen, in 2019, there was a series of irregularities in the lab. They had trouble with the ventilation system. They started to erase certain codes that were on file from the Institute. And probably somebody got sick in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and the virus was out. By the time Event 201 happened in the fall of 2019, the virus is already on the move. And that explains when they called certain leaders together, they had some U.S. senators, Anthony Fauci, all the pandemic response leaders at Event 201. They actually had George Gao, who's the Chinese CDC director. He flew over to the United States. So Event 201 was not a planning meeting. That was an operational meeting. They knew COVID had come out. They said what their plan was to actually railroad the population into mass vaccination.
Yeah. Criminal, it seems to me. Unbelievable. Well, let's, I know some of our viewers are going, huh? Like, if you've never heard that before, it's like, no way. The people we had put our trust in actually intentionally created something that would harm the population. And then—
Well, let's talk about that, Paul. You know, in 2005, the Health and Human Services and our Congress wrote the PREP Act. And they said, we are going to be in the business of developing biological threats and countermeasures, you know, things. So offense and defense. And they said that we're going to do this. And they named them SARS, anthrax, smallpox, monkeypox, Marburg. And they said, listen, if this ever happens, we're going to pull the trigger on the PREP Act. And we're going to basically release countermeasures. Countermeasures were things that, in a sense, like we'd be under attack, and these countermeasures would be immune from any liability. Vaccines were obviously prominent countermeasures. This was all in the PREP Act in 2005. So, you know, we don't hear about ballistic missiles anymore, or, you know, anti-missile radar shields and stuff. It's all now about biolab.
Yeah, yeah. It
and biological actually, warfare. This is the new normal. So the U.S. has been in the business, of making biological threats and coming up with countermeasures. It's big business. We found out on the DARPA website, DARPA, the research part of the military, that they had a program in 2012 called the ADEPT P3 program. And they said, we will use messenger RNA to end pandemics in 60 days. So this was, on the books in 2012, that indeed this was the plan. But what's happened is there is, in a sense, a syndicate and a complex. This is in our book, courage to face COVID-19. You're going to be astounded with this. It turns out that, in 2007, now CEO of Moderna, Stéphane Bancel, he was a pharmaceutical rep for one of the companies, and he became the kind of the country lead in the Belgium. And then he became CEO of BioMérieux. And between 2007 and 2011, BioMérieux actually got the contract to design and build the biosecurity lab in Wuhan, China, the BSL-4 annex, and train the personnel. So, Bancel, who still never has been asked about this, is what was his involvement in China before he comes to a one-person company in Cambridge, Moderna? And how did Moderna write patents before the COVID-19 was even known about and file them with the U.S. government? So Moderna filed it with the NIH. So the U.S. government's involved. And now we bring it forward. We find there's all kinds of people are involved. Recently, Peter Hotez, vaccine developer at Baylor in Houston, he's been called out because, he had research grants in 2015 and 2016 with the Chinese Fudan University developing receptor binding domain antigen vaccines as biological defense products. So he was in this biodefense area. He's been out telling Americans to take vaccines. People are saying, wait a minute here. This is looking like an entanglement. In our book, we call it the biopharmaceutical complex. So let me define it. The biopharmaceutical complex, we believe, is a World Economic Forum, World Health Organization, the Wellcome Trust, Rockefeller Foundation, Gates Foundation, the vaccine incubator they formed, CEPI, that's Gates and WF formed it, a Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, Gavi, Unitaid, the other vaccine NGOs, EcoHealth Alliance, and then the regulatory agencies. In this case, is actually HHS, CDC, NIH, FDA, TGA, MHRA, AFRA, EMA. There's a lot of acronyms, but it looks like they're all together. And the Central Coordinating Center, Paul, is the World Economic Forum. So if you ever have a question about who's in the complex or the syndicate, just check them out to see their profile in the World Economic Forum. They've been going to Davos for meetings for years.
Yeah.
So I can tell you, Governor Abbott in Texas, he's got a WEF profile. So does Justin Trudeau. So does the key regulators in Australia and through Europe. It's pretty obvious to figure this out.
Yeah. So I'm very worried about mRNA technology in general. My recollection, and you can speak to this from the science, is in the past when they tried to make mRNA vaccines for RSV, when they tried to make it for SARS and MERS, I don't think it went very well in the animal studies. But it seems like now they're just going to disregard all that and just move forward. It seems like it's coming like a freight train.
Messenger RNA has been an absolute disaster. This is what we know. A paper from Lalani and colleagues published in the British Medical Journal indicates that the U.S. has had billions and billions of dollars of investment in this, government dollars, in messenger RNA since 1985. 1985 hasn't gone anywhere. I told you about the DARPA ADEPT P3 program, 2012. That was a bust. And the messenger RNA that's used in Pfizer and Moderna, this is terrible. They've replaced normal uracil, which is a pyrimidine, with a synthetic molecule called pseudouridine. That makes the messenger RNA essentially indestructible. And so now it gets into the body. The body can't break it down with ribonucleases. The protein that it codes for is expressed on the cell surface. The body attacks it instantaneously. To make matters worse, they've loaded it on a lipid nanoparticle. Lipid nanoparticles go into the brain, the adrenal glands, the heart, the ovaries. Now we have papers, Paul, you'd be amazed. Castri Yuda and colleagues has found messenger RNA circulating in blood at high levels for 28 days. And that's as long as they've looked. Rotkin and colleagues from Stanford showed that the messenger RNA is stuck in lymph nodes for at least 2 months. The spike protein that it's produced, and we get full-length spike protein from the vaccine shown by Bruce Patterson at InCellDX, at least 9 months, maybe longer. Each shot, and if people are following the program, Paul, this summer, they're coming up on their seventh shot. their seventh shot. They are loaded with messenger RNA, Pfizer and Moderna brand, and then super loaded with the SARS-CoV-2 Wuhan spike protein. And this can be fatal in some people.
Yeah. So can you speak to the difference in the perhaps the load of spike protein or the load of messenger RNA that's in the body from a natural, it's hard to call it natural when you had a bioengineered virus, if you will. But is there a big difference if you get a natural exposure versus get the vaccine exposure?
There's a huge difference now. So let me update you. For the respiratory infection, virtually all the Americans have had it now. It's already done. It's gone through the population. We have seroprevalence data from the Framingham database, as well as from University of Texas at Houston School of Public Health, showing that virtually everybody has antibodies against the virus now. We've all had it. Paper from Harvard, Klassen and colleagues did really good modeling. 94% of people have had clinical infections, probably another 3% asymptomatic. So we've all had it. So what we know is that if we get the respiratory infection and we treat it aggressively with virucidal nasal sprays and washes, what's called the McCullough protocol, all the drugs used in combination, virtually none invades the body. So we don't get the installation of the spike protein in the body. What happens with the vaccine is a large dose of genetic material is installed, and then it circulates in the body for a long period of time, continuing to be deposited, used. And we infer that the body is super loaded with spike protein after the vaccine. We know that because the antibodies now, which there's an extended range, LabCorp just extended the range, are through the roof against the spike protein, and someone's taken the vaccine. That's a proxy for how much spike protein they got exposed to. And also there's a weak correlate that we use called D-dimer. But what we really need is just to measure the spike protein directly. Labs companies are working on that right now.
Okay. And so folks who've had the COVID shots and they have this massive amount of spike protein, is it true that the natural infection exposes a person to the entire sequence, whereas the vaccinated person, their antibodies are responding to the narrow spike protein? Or is there a difference there?
Well, it's true. The natural infection exposes, probably 29 proteins. In a paper by Hakim and colleagues, they can measure antibodies against 15 of them. So the natural infection, we get a much broader immunity, plus we activate T cells, natural killer cells, B cells. So we get both cellular and antibody-based immunity. And it is protective. I mean, this is the natural infection. There's a paper by Akima Talley showing 97% protection against severe outcomes with any prior COVID. And then a key paper by Chin and colleagues in the New England Journal of Medicine, October of 2022, U.S. prison system. This is amazing. 59,000 prisoners, 17,000 staff, huge study. If someone's been through the Omicron or Delta waves and they get another Omicron infection, zero risk of hospitalization and death, zero. So that's the reason why the hospitals are empty. There's no emergency. I had somebody today in my office get COVID. It's not a big deal. We just use the nasal sprays, few elements of the McCullough protocol. So natural immunity basically wins. What happened with the vaccine is it only exposes the patient to the spike protein, and it is the original spike protein that's been extinct a long time ago. So the body's immune system is being misdirected. And there's something called IgG subclass 4 switching, which basically means the body's immune system is misdirected and weakened. And so it can't handle an infection very well when they get it. And we know this now with a paper from Cleveland Clinic by Shretha and colleagues showed every single shot, there's a higher and higher risk of recurrent Omicron infections. The best healthcare workers are the unvaccinated.
Yeah. So you and I know this, and thank you for all those references to prove that point. However, many in America are hearing an opposite story on the news, right? All along, they were saying, oh, this is the disease of the unvaccinated. The hospitals are full of people who are unvaccinated. I have a sense of why that was, but can you explain it?
It looks like it was a propaganda campaign. I remember one day, in around June of 2021, like every single public figure, every single media person said it was a crisis on the unvaccinated. The efficacy of the vaccines can only be assessed in clinical trials. And what we know is the clinical trials never demonstrated a reduction in hospitalization and death. Never, never. Yeah. And now in emails that recently were released through FOIA, we know that CDC Director Walensky was emailing other CDC officers in January of 2021 saying the vaccine was failing and that fully vaccinated people were getting sick. And she said she's having calls with Anthony Fauci and with Francis Collins at the NIH. Yet they turned around and told America the vaccines worked and reduced acquisition of the virus, transmission, and reduced severe outcomes. It was a complete lie from the beginning. These are astounding numbers. What Walensky was referring to was a limited network of centers that were reporting to the CDC during early 2021. They ultimately published their findings in the MMWR in May of 2021. But listen to this. The CDC had recorded 10,262 fully vaccinated breakthrough infections, 10% hospitalized, 2% died. It was failing quick. And what we learned is it didn't stop transmission, didn't reduce severe outcomes. And the studies were biased that made that claim. Most of the studies were done by investigators, you know, whose institutions received COVID community core funding. So they were getting money to promote the vaccines. But they never really ascertained the vaccine status. The electronic medical record assumes they're unvaccinated. So if they did a quick data analysis from the EMR, they would say everybody in the hospital is unvaccinated because they never checked the CDC database, not available to them. And people on the ventilator can't produce their vaccine cards. So yeah, that was a fraudulent play. The cases weren't adjudicated for whether or not they had COVID or if they were just coming in with something else and testing positive. And as time went on, we found out that people test positive for many months afterwards. The other thing that happened is that the virus mutated and became more mild. So people started to say, well, the vaccine's working because hospitalizations are down. No, it's because the virus mutated. Because we didn't have a series, a good randomized trial program, any claims on vaccine efficacy at this point in time are invalid. There's no theoretical benefit. And actually, the FDA met this week and told the companies, well, why don't you make a booster for the XBB 1.5 variant? I just checked the Nowcast system. We're at 40% XBB 1.5 and shrinking rapidly. Can you imagine by the fall, there's not going to be any 1.5 left and the companies will have yet another useless vaccine.
Yeah, chasing their tail. And you've looked at the data carefully in some of these studies. I'm puzzled. I read that to be considered vaccinated, you had to have had your initial primary series and 2 weeks after that second dose or 2 weeks after a booster for you to be considered vaccinated, meaning that a lot of vaccinated people were actually in these studies being classified as unvaxxed. Is that true?
That's true. Remember, they should have used intent to treat principles, meaning once you intend to do it, everything counts. They were discounting all the infections between shot one and shot two, and there's an explosive number of infections, and they were not counting everything within 2 weeks of the second shot. So they were markedly overestimating efficacy because they were discounting all these infections the vaccinated were having.
Right. And when we look at the VAERS data, we see there's a clustering of side effects and adverse events right after the vaccines are given. And all those would be classified as unvaxxed people.
That's true. In fact, that was in the regulatory dossiers for Pfizer. Pfizer, under court order, was forced to release their dossier. Moderna, by the way, and Janssen is now off the market. Novavax still hasn't released their data. But Pfizer, it was an unqualified disaster. The FDA did not want to release this to Americans for over 55 years. And what we learned is people were explosively getting COVID after the first shot. It wasn't working. Pfizer recorded 1,223 deaths within 90 days of release of their vaccine, some on the same day they take the shot. And our government was trying to cover that up.
Wow. How come it's still on the market?
It shouldn't be. I've called on December 7th, 2022, for all the vaccines to be pulled off the market. I made that call in the U.S. Senate. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons made the same call in March of 2023. And then ahead of that, the World Council for Health, based out of the UK, made the call June 11th of 2022. Subsequently, we've had calls in the UK Parliament, the EU Parliament, Australian Parliament, pull the vaccines off the market, not safe for human use.
But nothing happens.
Even the emergency has been dropped. President Biden has dropped the COVID emergency, but the emergency use authorized vaccines continue. So no one is following any of the regulatory laws. They're not following good guidance. This seems to be a test of wills. Will the population of the world decline these vaccines and let them die? Or will people still take them? Our CDC is still reporting 15% of people are taking boosters. You know, I don't buy it right now because they're not updating the data. The number seems frozen forever. The U.S. military has completely dropped the vaccines. I got firsthand knowledge from Lieutenant Colonel retired Green Beret Pete Chambers, who told me that the most recent Defense Authorization Act finally got vaccines out of the new recruits, the reservists, and the currently enlisted and officers. So it's gone. The No College Mandates group has done a great job. We're fewer than 100 colleges mandating the vaccines. Companies are dropping them, but they never apologize for it, and they never state who is responsible for it to begin with.
So here's my biggest concern. I'm a retired pediatrician. My peers in pediatrics have been the biggest promoters of vaccines for the past several decades. And the ACIP, ACIP, you know, the CDC arm that makes recommendations, has put COVID on the childhood immunization schedule. And I know how my peers think. They think, oh, the CDC is recommending it and they are pushing it. What do you think? I mean, what are the adverse events that parents should look out for? And obviously, I'm saying, and I imagine you are also, absolutely not. Kids are not at risk from COVID at all.
No, at this point in time, they've all had it, Paul. There are no residual pockets of risk. Remember, there was never any school outbreaks, no kindergarten outbreaks. It was characteristically a very mild disease in children, very manageable, by the way. Modifications of the McCullough Protocol and others always handled it. Only people who were ever hospitalized were those who got no early treatment. And so it's always a manageable infection. And when ACIP put the vaccines on the routine schedule, and these are emergency use temporary vaccines, when they put them on the permanent ACIP panel, I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back. People said, listen, if this group is using their judgment, and if they really believe this, we need to take a look at the whole schedule. And that's what I've done, is take a look at the whole schedule and figure out what in the world was going on with these vaccine enthusiasts. And boy, the news is not good. What parents need to look out for is horrendous outcomes. A paper by Hoshida and colleagues from Japan. Listen to this. 14-year-old girl takes shot one of Pfizer, gets a little sick, shot two a few weeks later, gets a little more sick, gets a booster 6 months later, has some trouble breathing that night. She tells her sister that. The next morning, dead in bed, family is horrified. They get an autopsy. Every organ in the body is rotting out with inflammation. COVID-19 vaccine, multi-system inflammatory disorder.
Yeah,
I mean, this is horrendous. This is autopsy proven. It's in the peer-reviewed literature. One case of this back, you know, early in 2021 should have been pulled off the market.
Yeah.
Pulled off the market. So yeah. So parents should look for even horrific things, including death. We see now broad side effects in the cardiovascular category, myocarditis, 90% in boys, 10% in girls, blood clots, intracranial hemorrhage and stroke, like Hailey Bieber, who's the wife of Justin Bieber, Guillain-Barré syndrome in young people, hundreds of cases been reported. That's a neurologic paralysis. And then sadly, these immune system disorders, MISC and VITT, a blood disorder. But it's just basically a nightmare for children. They have no possibility of benefit, and it's all harm.
Yeah. All harm, folks. You hear that? It's it's an insane proposition to be even having that on the schedule. I think it's time to disband the CDC. They've gone insane. I mean, they're just too conflicted, apparently.
Well, it's clear that they've turned a blind eye to safety. They could care less if we lose children with the vaccine program. And we simply can't have agencies and committees making decisions if they don't care about the health of our children.
Yeah. So I've been looking at vaccines for the last 20 years, the childhood schedule, and I'm so excited to see your writing about this stuff. Your recent Substack Courageous Discourse on HIB was just brilliant. I mean, you've got all the data, and it's so nice to have a real scientist with a fresh look at this stuff. What are you finding as you sort of dive into this area? Is there a link between vaccines and autism?
You know, I got to tell you, I've been astounded with what I found out. Now, first off, let me say, I looked at my own vaccine schedule. I was born in 1962, and believe it or not, my mom took me in at 2 weeks and I started getting vaccinated. And I started getting vaccines back in the day. We took the oral polio vaccine, and then it was determined it didn't work. So then I was revaccinated with the shots, and it kept going. I was vaccinated and revaccinated over again. So I'm very heavily vaccinated. My kids took all the vaccines too. I didn't look at it critically when they were born. So let me tell you, just because, you know, I wasn't injured by the vaccines, it doesn't make it okay. Yeah. And I think it's very important for people to hear this. Just because they did fine with the vaccines doesn't mean it's okay. This is what we've learned. When I was a child, the rate of autism was 1 in 10,000. Now that rate today, the CDC says, is an emergency. It's 1 in 36. It's an epidemic. And there's an associated group of disorders that the Europeans are publishing on. It's called ESSENCE. This is important. I want to make sure we get this right cluster. It's attention deficit disorder, autism spectrum disorder, developmental coordination disability, intellectual and language disabilities, and Tourette's syndrome, and then in some cases, febrile seizures and epilepsy. So let me review the data, some contemporary studies. Just the MMR alone, in a paper by Habib and colleagues, where they compared the GlaxoSmithKline versus the Merck. So they were looking at both of them, but they had good quality data. The rate of febrile seizures, 0.4%. They're solid on this. So it's real, 0.4%. And then in a paper by Nielsen and colleagues, looking at all the febrile seizures in Sweden, it turns out 41% of them go on to develop one of these ESSENCE disorders, including autism spectrum disorders. Mm-hmm. So there's the linkage. And then what we're finding out is that as the vaccines are bundled into more intensive bundles, so you have MMR, which is measles, mumps, rubella, a DTP, which is diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, influenza, and now the Haemophilus influenza serotype B, and then we would add COVID into it. It's the adding up of these at single administration, the bundling of this, which looks like it's pretty clearly related to autism. A paper by DeLong, which is a brilliant analysis, children up to 8 years old, data from 2001 to 2007, carefully put this all together. And it was clear once the vaccines were given in these multiples and the bundles that the p-value for the development of autism is less than 0.001. So it's highly statistically significant. So we don't know. People have said, well, it's a preservative in one, like thiomersal, mercury, or it's aluminum in another. But you know, my analysis is that over time there's been some adjustment in these adjuvants. And by the way, aluminum's used in allergy testing injections and allergy desensitization with allergies too. I'm thinking now, certainly the adjuvants could play a role. But I'm thinking now that it's actually the immune system, that in some kids, the immune system is activated. And in fact, there's about 200 papers on immune system dysregulation and the development of autism and these ESSENCE, about 200 papers. So hypervaccination leads to immune system dysregulation. there are factors, cytokines that are neurotropic cytokines. They go into the brain just like they would with a measles encephalitis case or with rubella cerebritis case or with other illnesses. Some of the viruses were vaccinated against. The virus itself may not cause so much brain damage, but the inflammation does. When we give the vaccine, we're causing that same inflammation. Right. So what I've determined is that, while other hypotheses are in play, like the ascendancy of the use of glycosphates, potentially hypervitaminosis D or other things in the baby formula, we know that older parents, siblings with autism, and then premature infants, those are risk factors. But when you factor in these risk factors, hypervaccination, and then the vignette of a febrile seizure and the mother and father witnesses, and from that point forward, the child is never the same. I think we're building a pretty strong case that, that Andy Wakefield years ago, yourself and other pioneers, that you were right all along, that hypervaccination is a determinant of autism.
Yeah, it's huge. This makes it very, in medicine, we have this thing called informed consent. And I'm sure you've done this all your career when you're talking to a patient about some procedure that maybe they're needing to undergo or some medication. And here's the potential benefits. Here's the potential risks. You weigh it out and then they get to decide. My peers still believe that vaccines are safe and effective. So they're still just blanket statement. They're safe and effective. They hear this from the CDC. So then when you put that side of the equation against, well, these diseases can kill you, which, some of them can, that's the extent of their informed consent, which is so inadequate. When you know as much as you and I know, you have, if you're going to give informed consent, you've got to give the full story. And now it looks like vaccinating doesn't make much sense when you balance out the risks.
No, there's many tens of thousands of cases of autism, and it ranges in a spectrum. Some of the children, are homebound. They're 24/7, full care, screaming 24/7. I know some colleagues with children like this. Then others, they're relatively, mainstreamed. Intelligence, by the way, is quite variable. It's not a form of mental retardation. It's quite variable. Right. But compared to, these very rare outcomes, for instance, over 15 years of cases of measles in the United States, there were 34 deaths, and it was largely just in, cases. It's just supportive care. It's like any other viral encephalitis. By the way, a decent proportion of the measles hospitalizations and deaths, they're fully vaccinated. So measles doesn't stop severe disease. Same thing is true with mumps, diphtheria, and pertussis. Now, diphtheria and pertussis, they're treated with azithromycin, just a Z-Pak nowadays. So We have methods to easily treat a lot of these conditions. We have modern ICU care. I was on Twitter Spaces recently, and a doctor who worked for one of the big pharmaceutical companies said there's hundreds of thousands of measles deaths per year, and we have to keep up on measles vaccination. It's certainly not true in the United States. It's very rare to have measles. It's easily treated. We can treat the other illnesses, deep tissue wounds. We treat tetanus if it's there. We have a situation where most of the vaccines are not medically necessary, not clinically indicated, and the risks to the child may far outweigh the benefits in most cases. Now, people could say, well, wait a minute, we still have some severe things to talk about, like polio. Well, polio was going down considerably before the vaccines even came. And the first ones, the ones I got, for instance, they didn't even work anyway. Yeah. So then we had to be revaccinated. And actually the oral polio vaccines just contributed more polio in the water supply. So it was a terrible development. So, the polio vaccines didn't end polio. Smallpox over 70 years reduced smallpox infections, but human hygiene improved. I got the smallpox vaccine too. I checked out my vaccine card. And so now we're down to some things like Haemophilus influenza B. Do you know, over about 10 years of data, there were 4,000 cases of Haemophilus influenza. Only 77 were serotype B.
Right.
Meaning we get Haemophilus, but it's only this one serotype. And you know, the large fraction of them were either partially or fully vaccinated.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We're protecting against the wrong strain.
Yeah. So we're vaccinating against a pretty rare strain and it doesn't even work anyway. So none of these vaccines look pretty good. I got to say, probably the one that's most compelling would be rubella. Now, rubella didn't exist when I was a kid. I remember they started a rubella campaign. And before they started, there was about 20,000 cases of congenital rubella syndrome, German measles.
Yeah.
It was
devastating when you acquire it while pregnant.
Right. It was just like Zika virus. It is terrible when you get it when you're pregnant. And it turns out of the kids who survived, Paul, it's interesting, of the kids who survived to birth, about 10% had autism back in the 60s. So the congenital rubella syndrome, believe it or not, did result in some autism.
Yeah.
And then the rubella vaccines came in and, you know, the number of congenital rubella cases plummeted from 20,000 to 2. It really worked. Yeah. Now, who needs the vaccine? It's women as they approach the reproductive years. What happened? You know, it was the decision of the CDC, ACIP, and I think at the time it was a public health service, to say that everybody has to take, you know, young boys don't get significant German measles. It's like
exactly.
So we over-vaccinated the boys, myself included. Yeah. And it simply wasn't needed. But the rubella vaccine looks compelling. And I have to say another vaccine I think that looks, I think, prudent, and that would be hepatitis B in two circumstances. One, in babies who are born to mothers with active hepatitis B, where we want to get them some immunity. That's pretty rare, like an active IV drug abusing mother. And it's more frequent in Asia, where they do have more endemic hepatitis B. Right. And then I'd say healthcare workers, people with working with blood and body fluids as they approach healthcare. But that's it. You can see the overreaction here. Every baby now is being vaccinated in the first day of life with hepatitis B. All these normal babies, they're not, you know, all the mothers in America are not IV drug abusers. So no. I think we could basically do... What you've proposed in your manuscripts and Hooker and Miller, and that is go natural. And so the outcomes of going natural, no vaccines at all, are spectacular.
Amazing.
As you've reported, lower rates of asthma, atopic dermatitis, need for tympanostomy tubes, attention deficit disorder, autism, other neuropsychiatric disorders. It's absolutely stunning. Going natural, far better than following the vaccine schedule.
Yep. And it's not that dangerous. You know, when I coach people today, because I don't practice medicine anymore, I'm retired. That was another whole story. But when I coach people today, you know, I say, well, you know, you've got to weigh it out. And what are you most afraid of? And really the logical decision now, knowing what we now know, is let nature protect you. Natural immunity is amazing. So thank you for, wow, you're a fast study. I know that about you. You're just prolific in your ability to analyze studies and figure stuff out. So we've needed you in this realm as well. I wanted to ask you one other question as we get close to winding it down. I feel like scientific integrity has really taken a hit with COVID. It's like so much science anymore because it's so pharma dominated with conflicts of interest. It almost feels like tobacco science where, you know, you have good science showing one thing, but the pharmaceutical industry wants to bury that with a bunch of junk studies. So then things, well, okay, you've got one study that maybe, but we have 10 studies that prove the opposite. How do we recover the integrity of medicine? How do we recover the integrity of science itself?
We're in dark times right now, Paul. What we've learned is things went off the rail with vaccines decades ago. There's been about 150 years of vaccine ideology where no one could challenge the vaccines. They were assumed safe, and no one could actually review them. And in fact, fraudulent papers were published. There was one published around 2000. First author is Madsen, a separate one from the same database by Hivig. These studies claimed there was no relation between the MMR vaccine and autism. And well, how did they do this? They looked at automated sources of data, and they assumed that when the MMR didn't show up in a billing code, that they didn't take the MMR. So they had a group of vaccinated. In the Madsen study, they came up with 82% of the kids vaccinated, but 18% unvaccinated. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. I said, wait a minute. During that time period, there was only about 2.5% of Americans unvaccinated. What about this 18.2? So I immediately thought that they didn't have the right classification of who was vaccinated or not. And sure enough, I found a paper published at that time showing that in Denmark, the automated data system was not getting complete capture of vaccination. And easily, I think it was 55% of those, quote, who were unvaccinated, in fact, were vaccinated. So the Madsen paper is actually flawed because both groups are vaccinated. And of course, when both groups are vaccinated, you're not going to see any relative difference in autism rates. So Madsen and then the associated paper, Hivig, in Annals of Internal Medicine, really can just be tossed out based on they're invalid. So in the vaccine world, when it came to declarations that the vaccines didn't cause autism, I think every one of those studies is flawed. And they are quickly trying to dismiss any concerns to keep the vaccine ideology going. We've seen the same thing now with COVID, that we see papers all the time that say, well, this is pretty rare, and then they get into it. Now, it's interesting, if they describe the rarity enough, sometimes the editors let it get in. Let me give an example. Paper published in a very high-level cardiology journal by Cho and colleagues from Korea. Do a calculation based on spontaneous reporting of myocarditis being rare in young people. Well, we don't use spontaneously reported safety data and divide it by the entire population because we never know of cases that aren't reported because they may have died at home or doctors don't recognize it. So they use this invalid technique to get to a low incidence, and they make that the play of the paper. But I looked in detail. Believe it or not, in Korea, they are reporting 480 cases of myocarditis severe enough to be hospitalized. 21 of them went on ECMO, which is a very serious level of life support, and they died. They died. 21 young people died despite full ICU report. So the Cho report is an indictment, for instance, that is a disaster. But the only reason why it's published is because the authors are trying to feign that this is rare. So it takes a critical reader. We are now relying on the preprint server system a lot, which is fair. I just reviewed some CDC papers. They're referencing 50% or more preprint server papers. So we can use a preprint server system and actually take a look at the data ourselves. Independent medical journals are coming forward. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons is now a popular independent medical journal. The Journal of Science, Technology, Public Health, and Law by the Institute of Applied Technology, that's another one. And you'll see that truth will ring true. We have a situation with COVID that 25% of the population didn't take the vaccine, and the doctors are still telling some of the patients to take the vaccine. They are running and changing doctors to doctors who are being honest about the vaccines. And I tell you, the medical community better figure this out because there's going to be a big shift in patient preference.
Yeah. You just gave me an idea of a question to ask you that I've never thought of asking somebody of your caliber. How do you, and I really want to know the answer for myself, I like to find good studies, and I don't like missing good studies because I didn't know they were there. What is your approach? Now, you just speak to other physicians and scientists out there. What is the best approach to make sure you don't miss good science? Like, how do you get a hold of all the articles you need to get a hold of?
Well, you know, I work very hard at it. I get up very early in the morning. I dedicate hours to scholarship. You know, I'm still in practice, so I go to the office. I'm seeing patients, taking patient phone calls. But I certainly work hard at it. Now, I've published more than anybody in my field, so I'm quick with the data. I just understand how to interpret papers. I use the National Library of Medicine every day. But I rely on communication systems. I started one for COVID called C19D, and every day there's periodic updates, and I'm always being alerted to papers. I started a Substack, Courageous Discourse, where I make the graphical abstract, quick commentary, voiceover, sometimes key videos, and we get this out. And we just create dialogue. And I'm really focusing now on COVID-19, vaccines in general, autism, and actually transgenderism. Transgenderism, Paul, a topic for another day. I'd like to take it up with you. But there is a connection between it all.
Fascinating. Yeah, we'll definitely take that up on another time. It's happening. I have a grandson who's 17, and he said it's all over his school. It's just like, you know, 5 years ago, it was almost unheard of. And now it's the thing. A lot of social pressure involved, but we'll talk about that some more for sure. So as we wrap it up, two things. First, what's coming next? You know, we've seen these huge organizations that you were able to connect who are up to no good in one sense. What do you think's coming next, and should we be afraid?
Well, this biopharmaceutical complex is giving us all the overt signaling. Bill Gates, Tedros of the WHO, Anthony Fauci, former NIA director, Peter Hotez in Houston, controversial vaccine developer. They are all stating with great enthusiasm that there will be another pandemic and that it'll be far worse than COVID. Well, why are they saying this? And why are they so happy about it? I think we should take them seriously. There could be another pandemic. It could be another respiratory virus. We need to be ready. Principles of the McCullough Protocol, viricidal nasal washes and sprays, key over-the-counter nutraceuticals and supplements. Everybody ought to go to my website, petermccullohmd.com, and get armed because there could be another pandemic. I personally don't think it's going to happen because it's very hard for a virus to infect the entire world. We may see little sputtering outbreaks like monkeypox. And by the way, the complex tried to pull the trigger on monkeypox. Even today, the CDC is telling people to get both monkeypox and COVID shots. Today, the CDC is doing it. I think the other thing to watch now is this transgenderism and this convergence with autism is going to be explosive. Explosive. The Autism Advocacy Network has come out fully in support of transgender medicine, and they're trying to fight all the legislation to shut it down. The American Civil Liberties Union has come out fully in support of transgenderism, trying to block any state regulations on this. All the academic medical centers are going wild with surgical and hormonal programs targeting the children largely with autism. The Endocrine Society, the American College of Pediatrics, and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, all fully supporting transgender medicine. I think this is going to be a really dark time in medicine, similar to the days of frontal lobotomy. Frontal lobotomy went on for years, Paul. You know, it basically took people with minor psychiatric problems and made them vegetables. Yeah. And it took Peter Bregan, who's still alive today, a modern day hero, to stand up to it and say, no, it's got to stop. Do you know the guy who's promoting frontal lobotomy? He got a Nobel Prize. So listen, medicine goes in bad directions right now. We're at a time where that's happening. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough, Paul. I'm going to have to sign off and jump on another show. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show. God bless.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.